Hello, everyone, and welcome to Keep or Cut, a proud member of the Pitcherless Podcast Network. Chad, we are at episode 103. Can you believe it? 103.
103. That's a lot. It's not a small number of episodes.
It is not a small number of episodes, and I just glossed over all the important stuff. So please follow Chad at Chad Young. You can follow the show at Keep or Cut. You can follow me at Pete B Baseball. Today, we're going to kind of do the opposite of what we did two episodes ago, where we looked at guys who were like way overperforming and looking like great keepers because they were taken super late in drafts, but they were currently ranked in the top 50, 100, I think it was top 100 on ESPN's Player Radar. Today we're going to do the opposite, but before we get into more information on that, we have a lot of news that Chad and I want to talk about. And the first one, maybe the most important news, Chad, is that Ellie De La Cruz has been promoted to the major leagues since the last time we spoke, and he has lit the baseball world on fire.
Yeah, it's almost like I have nothing to say, but it's not because there isn't plenty to say. It's just like go do a Google search for Ellie De La Cruz and bask in the glory. Like go watch some video of him smashing baseballs, like watch clips of him running the bases. He's just like, he's so fun to watch because it's like, all right, I'm going to go out there and like hit 117 mile per hour rocket that goes 450 feet. And like nearly leaves the stadium. And the next time up, I'm going to run the fastest home to third in the season this year, something like that. It's like, oh man, this guy, he's a star.
It was a straight up just a routine ground ball. Like, I don't know how to phrase it any other way. That they didn't even throw it. He was already at first base. Did you see that? It was the most like amazing thing I've ever seen. It was just like, wait a second. Why did you throw the ball? Oh, because he's like rounding first.
Right.
There isn't a lot to say. We have a lot to get into, but looking at his Statcast page is just so much fun. So he was called up on June 6th. That was Tuesday. He's only accrued 9 batted balls. So like, just keep that in mind. His average exit velocity is 99.8. His max EV is already in the 96th percentile, and his sprint speed is in the 100th percentile. Like, that's fun. I'm sorry. That's fun. Oh.
And I will say, I think like if you are, like, so as a baseball fan with kids, right? I got a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old. At this moment in time, I have this, like, I feel like we're at this, like, incredible moment where I can still show them a guy like Mike Trout, who's one of the best to ever play, even though I think we're starting to see him maybe hitting a little bit of a decline, maybe.
He's still very good, I hope not.
But regardless, he's still around. You still have pitchers like Verlander, Scherzer, like some of these guys that are great. But they get to see, like, a kid growing up right now watching baseball gets to see Shohei Ohtani in his prime, gets to see Aaron Judge in his prime, and is now going to grow up with guys like Ellie, guys like Julio Rodriguez, guys like Corbin Carroll. Assuming he gets back to sort of what we expect from him, a guy like Tatis. There's just like a flood, I feel like, of this just like, not just like talented young players, but exciting, fun, talented young players. Guys who are doing a little bit of everything on the field, doing it in an exciting way. It's a really fun time, I think, to be watching baseball. And maybe that's always true. But I think, like, I don't know, I go back to like when I was getting into baseball and you had Griffey, later you had A-Rod. But then you went through a period of time where all the stars were just like big hulking sluggers. And not that there's anything wrong with big hulking sluggers. I love myself a good big hulking slugger. But there's something really fun right now about just like, that's not who these guys are. They're not guys that you like look at and you're like, wow, that guy's huge and he can smash the ball forever, but that's sort of all he can do. These are guys who are, they run and they play the field well, and they just it makes the game really fun to watch when you can go see guys like that.
And I do think, I mean, you touched upon him there. Ohtani is what makes it just so special.
Puts it over the top for sure.
I am selfishly hoping that Ellie De La Cruz does not make the Rookie of the Year race competitive because, long story short, I am not a gambling man. Okay, I'm just not. But DraftKings had this like promotional. I got a free $25. I said, you know what? I don't think the favorite at the time for NBA MVP was Jokic. I'm like, you know what? There's no way they're going to go for Jokic 3 years in a row. It's just not, he's not liked enough to win that. So I threw it all in Embiid, won some money. Cool, whatever. And I was too lazy to get it. Well, exactly. I was too lazy to send that check to my house. So I was like, all right, let's, I looked at the Rookie of the Year race and I was like, there is no chance that James Outman is the favorite right now with his 35% K rate or whatever it was. So I got Corbin Carroll at +200 and I just threw all the Embiid money on that. I'm like, whatever, this is fake money. This is play money. And I'm feeling really good. And then I watched Ellie De La Cruz play. I'm like, oh God, I hope so Carroll has built up enough of a lead here.
So we talked about this in the Autonew Slack right around when Ellie was getting called up. And there was this conversation always comes up when a rookie gets called up about, like, you know, why is the team calling this player up now? And with Ellie, I think one of the things that came up was, like, if you're Cincinnati, you could have called them up a month ago, 6 weeks ago, whatever, and been eligible for that draft pick compensation if he ends up as Rookie of the Year. Or you could have called him up in like 2 months and lined him up to get you that draft pick compensation next year because you could keep him still rookie eligible. Instead, they called him up now and they're sort of in this weird in-between zone where, like, they can't get any compensation, but he's going to use up his rookie eligibility unless he sucks. That hasn't been an issue. I don't think it's going to be an issue. So he's going to use up his rookie eligibility. And now if he ends up as what, it's top two or top three, he gets a full year of service time and the Reds get nothing. Right. Which, hey, I hope he gets that service time, right? Like that would be awesome. That'd be great for him. It gets him to free agency a year earlier, which will get him more money. And if the Reds are good and they extend him, it'll cost them a little more. That's fine. And if they're not and he wants to leave, it'll get him to a better team sooner. Like, it's all good as far as I'm concerned. But it was an interesting question. And one of the things I said at the time was, I think it's wide open for him to get into the top two or three and potentially get that service time. But I kind of think the Rookie of the Year is locked up in the NL.
I hope so.
I don't see him like,
the fielding separates it. Corbin Carroll does not strike out that much, so he's not going to have prolonged slumps. Like, I right. do think it's probably locked up. Francisco Alvarez, making things a little interesting, but he got his first start at DH, I think it was last week, and if he DHs the whole time, and even if he just performs, like, almost neck and neck with Carroll the rest of the way, I don't think it's enough to dislodge Carroll. But it could be enough to keep Ellie, you know, if somebody else emerges, Ellie goes on a little bit of a slump outside of that top three, so maybe the Reds end up okay, but... I'm sort of with you. There's not a lot so far that makes me think Ellie's gonna really disappoint here, but who knows?
I don't think it's a disappointment. And when I say, yeah, and when I say Carroll's got this locked up, I think part of this is, like, you know, we talked about how exciting Ellie is off these nine plate appearances, blah, blah, blah. Corbin Carroll has a 92nd percentile max exit velocity. He has 99th percentile sprint speed. Like, all the things we said about Ellie are also true about Corbin Carroll. And I actually, like, in a weird way, I feel like people are sleeping on Corbin Carroll a bit. Like, they're missing how fun he is. And all this Ellie talk, like, it almost makes me wonder, like, had the Diamondbacks waited a month and called up Carroll on, like, May 1st, in between, you know, a bunch of guys are up opening day, a bunch of guys are going to come up after Super 2, blah, blah, blah. And, like, they call it, would he have gotten this kind of attention? Because he's just as exciting. I mean, like, if you look at, you know, Statcast sliders, not everything, but if you look at Corbin Carroll's Statcast sliders, it is all red, and it is a lot of dark red, except for his arm strength. He doesn't have the best arm. Fine. But he's an elite defender who is an elite base runner who has elite max exit velocity. That's pretty awesome. And so... And I do think the biggest advantage Carroll has is he does control those strikeouts. He, you know, it was last year, he only got 115 major league plate appearances, which is what kept him rookie eligible. He stayed, I think it's 130 at bats you need, and he had 104 at bats. So he was, you know, a week away from losing eligibility, but he kept it. And he struck out 27% of the time last year to Carroll. He brought that down. It's under 20% this year. Right. And he's had a history of like 22, 23, 25% strikeout rates in the minors. But like, if he's going to strike out under 20% time, even if it goes up to 22, 23%, because I think it might, like, no one's going to catch him. He has too big an advantage, right? He has three, on Fangraphs, three F4 already, right? I mean, he is on his way to a 7-win season. Like, I mean, 7 wins is getting closer to MVP category than it is
that
to
is,
just like,
that is will he 100% MVP yeah. category.
And you go, I mean, I don't know where the D-backs are. They started off really well. Where are they in the standings these days? The Diamondbacks, they're still in first. If the Diamondbacks win the West, they're only 2.5 games up in the Dodgers. If you end up with some more money in that DraftKings bet and you want to place it on something, the Dodgers over the Diamondbacks seems like a decent bet to make.
Yeah, but I would agree.
If the Diamondbacks win that division, if the Diamondbacks make the playoffs and Corbin Carroll puts up a 7 or 8 win season, he might be the MVP. And he's not going to win MVP and have Ellie win Rookie of the Year. So
it's a good point. He's not going to finish third in MVP and Ellie win Rookie of the Year.
Right.
And right now he has to be second to Acuna. So unless I'm missing somebody pretty obvious, I mean, Freeman is obviously having a phenomenal season, but I don't know. I think Carroll would have my vote.
If you look at the WAR leaders in the National League for bats on Fangraphs, you've got Acuna first at 3.2, Freeman second at 3.1, Sean Murphy is at 3, Corbin Carroll is at 3, Mookie Betts is at 3. So those are your top, what is that, 5 names among bats. If I look at pitchers, Zach Gallen is first at 3.1. Zach Wheeler second at 2.6. I think in general, pitchers need to be more than leading the league in WAR to really considered for MVP, right? They need to be running. So if Gallen puts up a 10-win season and nobody else is above 8, that might be enough for people to be like, he gets both awards. That's not what I'm expecting to happen. So I do think it'll be one of the bats. And if I look at those bats, I mean, I think the fact that the Diamondbacks are so much better than they were expected to be plays to Carroll's advantage.
For sure.
Right? If he keeps it close to Acuna and Freeman and Murphy and Betts, right? Because like I said, those are the sort of clear top 5 right now. The next in the National League, by the way, is Dansby Swanson down at 2.3. So there's a pretty big drop at that point. If you take those 5, it is going to be very easy for voters to be like, first of all, there's 2 Dodgers, there's 2 Atlanta players. Like, and Carroll is the one who I think will get the bonus of like, he elevated his team. If it weren't for him, is this team where it is? Like, Acuna missed a bunch of time last year and Atlanta was really good. Right. Like, I think it's just easier to look at the Dodgers and be like, they're a super team. And it's easier to look at Atlanta and be like, they were already good and say, like, you know, if you're comparing these 5 players and, you know, we'll see where they all end up. But if you're comparing these 5 players and you have to pick the one who is the most valuable, the stats don't separate them. And if the stats don't separate them, I think the Diamondbacks story might.
Yeah, the narrative for sure. So we've got more prospects to talk about outside of just Corbin and Ellie, although they definitely are the most exciting. And Chad, you and I were having a conversation yesterday. I just asked you, like, who's worth stashing more? Christian Encarnacion Strand, a former teammate of Ellie De La Cruz and hopefully a soon-to-be teammate of Ellie De La Cruz, but also, or I should say, Colton Cowser, who has recently come back from injury for the Orioles AAA affiliate. He's hitting the ball well already. The GM hinted that he might be coming up soon with Mullins out and that he needs to get his feet under him at AAA first. And then I said, well, I also have Jordan Westberg. So those 2 guys were available. Should I drop Westberg and pick up both of them? So real quick, Chad, let's rank them. Christian Encarnacion Strand, Jordan Westberg, Colton Cowser for 2023.
For 2023. So we're being very specific for this year. Boy, that's an interesting one. I mean, I think for me, it's probably Cowser, but boy, you could make a case. geez, you can make a case for any of them, really. I think the maybe the biggest challenge for Encarnacion Strand is playing time. Because right now, I mean, Joey Votto is working his way back. And the Reds have already called up. They've called up three players already, right? They've called up McLean. They've called up Steer, really. I mean, I don't know if you count him as a call-up. I do, because he was a prospect to start the year. And then they've called up Ellie. And, like, you look at their lineups the last few days, they've been... So they've been using Tyler Stevenson, another good young player. Man, that team is fun. Cincinnati's just a fun team. I'm just taking a moment to think about that. But they've been using Tyler Stevenson at multiple spots. They had said before the season that Stevenson was going to, like, catch 4 to 5 out of every 10 games, play first base 2 to 3 games, DH the rest. Like, they're going to keep him in the lineup as much as possible. I haven't seen him playing as much first base. I can look that up. It doesn't really matter. But he is DHing a decent amount. And regardless, he is using up some spot other than catcher half the time, something like that. They've been using Steer for the most part at first base. He's played first base, let's see, three of the last four games. Their other first baseman right now is Kevin Newman. Kevin Newman, not going to keep that first base job, I don't think. But Votto comes back. He takes that spot. And the other place you could put Encarnacion Strand is third base. And Ellie's playing third base right now because McLean is playing shortstop. So, and I guess I should say they're moving around. I mean, like, yesterday, Jonathan India was at second. And he's still, like, that's still his position. McLean at short, Ellie at third, Steer at first, Stevenson at DH. The day before that, they had Newman at third, Ellie at short, McLean at second, Steer at first, India at DH. The day before that was Ellie at third, McLean at short, India at second, Newman at first, Stevenson at DH, and Steer in the outfield. He played left. My fantasy teams would really appreciate if they would keep that going, just getting Steer some, because he's going to lose. He's got middle infield eligibility and not new, but he's going to lose it after this year. And so adding outfield would be nice. Day before that, Steer at first, India second, De La Cruz at short, McLean at DH, Newman at third, and Stevenson was catching that day. So Newman is sort of slotting in and out occasionally. He's playing, I guess he's playing almost every day now in one of these spots, just varies which one it is. He's going to lose that when Votto comes back because Votto is going to lock down first base. And then I don't know where CES goes.
Right.
So that's my biggest question, because, you know, the other big concern with him was, like, some swing and miss in his game. But, like, his strikeout rate's down to 22.1% now. That's a AAA. It'll go up when he gets up. But he's, like, he's really improved on that front. And he's got, I think, fairly clearly the biggest power of the three. I mean, he hit 32 home runs last year. He has 17 already this year. Couser hit 19 last year. Westberg also has 17 this year. He hit 27 last year. So maybe he's not very clearly the most powerful of three. But,
well, that's actually my issue with Westberg.
Okay.
Because I... Like, Encarnacion Strand, obviously, I'm buying the power. The swing and miss stuff, even though it looks like it might be improved at AAA, it still concerns me because I feel like these guys with marginal swing and miss issues, when they hit the major leagues, they get slammed. And we've seen that over the years. So we just talked about that in a recent episode with Volpe and Henderson and guys like that. And there's more, apparently, swing and miss in Encarnacion Strand's game. But with Westberg, it's already kind of middling power. At least it's projecting out to be kind of middling power. Not bad, not great. And when you look at the Statcast park factors for home runs at Camden for right-handed batters, and yes, Couser is also an Oriole, but he's a lefty, which is very different at Camden.
Oh, yeah.
They are third to last this year. So I took off the three-year rolling because that would include 3 years ago, obviously, when the fences were not moved back. But ever since then, Baltimore has been a hole for right-handed batters. So I'm worried that power is not really going to play up that much, at least in his first season or so for Westberg. So even though I actually think he's probably most likely out of these three to get called up the soonest, I think the ceiling, at least in 2023, is maybe the lowest. Encarnacion Strand, I think he might have the lowest floor out of the three with the swing and miss issues. So I think I'm with you. That's my long way of saying I like Couser the most out of this trio.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, and I hadn't even gotten to Couser yet, but I think he's the most advanced bat of the three. I think he's
also the highest rated prospect of the three, like substantially.
Yeah, and that, I mean, I know that, you know, sometimes it feels like, oh, well, like ratings, well, anybody can be rated wherever. It's like, yeah, but there's a reason that people who are actual scouts and actually do this for a living are saying that.
Right.
And I think it's,
so we have to look at something.
Right. So I do think, I do think you're right. I would go with Couser. I also think Couser's my favorite long-term. I think that's actually an easier one for me to say is like of these three, who do I want for the next 3 to 5 years? It's definitely Couser. For this year, I think it's probably Couser. Who the most valuable of these three this year is going to come down to two things. One is opportunity, which is hard to predict. And they all are sort of, I think Couser probably has the best opportunity, but Westberg is right there. CES should be up soon. Like it's hard to sort of debate. I don't know. I don't know how you parse between those. And the other is just who adjusts quickest. And I have no real good way to evaluate that other than, I guess, the swing and miss concerns with Encarnacion Strand, maybe push him down a notch. But like, it's, I don't know. It's honestly guesswork a little bit who's going to be better this year. I think there's more you can lean on to look at who's going to be better long term. And that's where like the way scouts view him, the track record of success, Couser just, he stands out to me.
It also seems like a more diverse skill set. So that's our take. We're going with Couser, but I'd be happy to have any of them if they get called up. So be on the lookout. If you're in a shallow league and they're not added, I'd be ready to pounce. Chad, we glossed over something. I'm just butchering this host job here. It is our third episode, which to me means it's our Babe Ruth episode. But as you pointed out, Babe Ruth only wore it for 7 years because apparently jersey numbers were not worn before then. But whatever the case, this will be the Babe Ruth episode to me. Who do you got for number three?
Yeah, I mean, Ruth is got to be it, right? I mean, I think he is the all-time leader among players who wore the number three in war over on Baseball Reference. And it's not close. Even though he only wore it for 7 years, it's like the guys who are behind him. First of all, he only wore it for 7 years, as you said, because jersey numbers weren't a thing before that. So not his fault. It's not like he wore some other number. But like number two on that list is A-Rod. And A-Rod only wore it for 10 years because he wore it with the Mariners when he came up and he wore it with Texas. And then he went to New York. And it turns out in New York, there was a guy who had gotten that number retired. And so A-Rod had to move on from that. If you're looking for other names that are on here, Jimmy Fox wore it for 12 years. He started wearing it in 31. So, you know, maybe that's a similar thing. Maybe there was time before that. I don't remember when Fox started his career, but he wore it for 12 years. Yeah. Ken Griffey Jr. wore it for 3 years with when he was with the Reds. He didn't wear it in Seattle. Alan Trammell wore it for 19 years. There's some guys who were, I think, theoretically better players than Trammell who wore it for like a year here, a couple years there, whatever. But Alan Trammell wearing it for 19 years feels like a guy who deserves some recognition for owning that number. But when it's Babe Ruth's number, only one person can really own it.
Yeah, when someone has like 50 war on the guy after him or 60 war, whatever it is, I'm with you. Special shout outs to Harmon Killebrew, who's a great MLB Showdown card. It was like a card playing game when I was a kid. And Evan Longoria, maybe my favorite baseball player of all time, who worked for 11 years there with the Rays. So we got our number business done. This is the Babe Ruth episode, a big upgrade from last week's. We have some more prospect stuff here, Chad. James Wood, I mean, I guess we can start with him. Hit a monster home run the other night at Double A. He looks like he's starting to adjust pretty well. Speaking of guys who had some swing and miss issues, you kind of put this in the notes here, so I want to see where you want to take it. We got some elite names here. What do you want to talk about with them?
Yeah, so this is coming up because in our listener league, our listener auto new league where I am selling, I had offers open from a team. There's a team in that league who has Churio, Wood, and Junior Caminero, which is a pretty good trio of guys to have, and basically said, you can have any of the three for Aaron Nola. And then I got an offer that was Nola and Machado for Tanner Bibee and Westberg, who we just talked about. And I was like, it was one of these moments where I was just like overwhelmed with choice. I was like, I don't know what to make of this. Like, I don't even know if any of these are good offers because there's just so much happening here. I pinged our friend of the pod, Matt Heckman, and was like, rank these three dudes in double A for me. Like, if you had to pick one of them. And he said he actually, he likes Wood the, or he likes Wood the most long term, but Churio the most for Otto New because he thinks he's closer. And I was like, okay, I could sort of see that. And then he sort of encouraged me to be like, and I was in a situation where it's like, I really like Tanner Bibee, but the trade offer for Bibee was both Nola and Machado for Bibee and Westberg. And then the Nola loan offer was for these three guys. It was like, I'd really like to get like Churio and Bibee, but that obviously isn't on the table. And then Matt was like, do you really want to trade a guy like Nola for one prospect, even if he's a great prospect? And I was like, I don't know. Maybe I don't. Like, maybe that's not the right thing to do. And I ended up turning down all four of the offers that were outstanding.
Oh, wow.
And not taking any of those guys because I don't know. I'm looking at maybe it's I'm looking at the deals you're making in that league, but like you've done a really good job of not settling, honestly, not settling for prospects, let alone not settling for one prospect, right? Like if I go, I'm trying to pull this up right now. If I go to this league, for those who aren't in the league, it's League 1372. If you want to pull up League 1372, and if I go to your recent trades, you traded away Matt Olson. You got Mitch Keller and O'Neill Cruz. You traded away Jorge Soler and Corey Seager. You got Wander Franco. You also got Alek Manoah. We talked about Manoah on that episode. I've managed to get some guys I really like. I got Royce Lewis and Evan Carter. Did I make another trade? I feel like I did, but now I can't remember. Oh, no. Yeah. Then I was able to get Andre Jimenez, Logan Ohapi, Spencer Steer, and Colton Cowser. A couple guys we talked about just recently. And a guy we're going to talk about later, sadly. I feel like we've both done a good job, although I will be honest, you have inspired me to focus on this, is like, get guys who are doing it now. Get guys who you can like pencil into your lineup without being like, you know, if they develop, if they make it in the majors. And it felt light. And so I ended up being like, you know what? I'm going to back off. It didn't help me that Nola pitched poorly again last night. I do think Machado's value is going up.
He only kind of pitched poorly.
Only kind of?
He pitched poorly in a very Aaron Nola way, where like the earned runs look bad, but everything else is like, why is this guy giving up runs? Because he's nasty. I think he led baseball in swing and misses last night. So,
oh, really?
Whatever that's worth. Yeah. He's just nasty. I don't know. Yeah. This has been his problem, except last year, where it's like, what is wrong?
Yeah. No, you're right. He had seven strikeouts,
but I'm with you on that. Okay.
And it was against the Dodgers, right? He gave up seven strikeouts, two walks. He gave up one home run, and then he had like six other hits and ended up with a 39.5% left on base rate. Like that's been his issue in the past, is that he cannot strand runners. And maybe that's like, that has certainly been an issue this year. 62.5% left on base for Nola is not good.
Right.
But I feel like I feel like he will pitch better moving forward, and I'd rather get more for him.
Yeah. I mean, you're selling low, and it's just to get one prospect who, no matter which one it is, you can make a case that none of those guys are going to be up this year. I like acquiring players that are going to be here now if I can, right? Like if you have the option. What's tough is when there's a limited amount of buyers. And I think we see that in rotisserie leagues, right? Where like the pool of buyers becomes so small especially guys who are willing to give up like potentially immense talent for what are clearly rentals. In the head-to-head format, though, you could have buyers all over the standings. It makes it a little bit easier to sell. Like last year, I had no problem buying Corbin Carroll, even though he wasn't called up yet, because it's Corbin Carroll, first of all, and he was at AAA, unlike those names that you mentioned. But also it was a head-to-head league, so it was a little bit easier to bring in pieces. I think that's going to be a challenge in rotisserie leagues. If you're going to sell in a roto league, I mean, you're going to sell anywhere. It's best to make up your mind early, but definitely in a rotisserie league. The longer you wait, those fourth, fifth, sixth place teams, they're like, you know what? I can't win it this year. I'm going to sell too. And that just makes it difficult.
Yeah. Right now in this league, things are getting closer at the top, which is helpful. So like a few days ago, the first place team was up over 80 points and the second place team was like 10 points back. And now there are three teams within like 6 or 7 points of each other. And there's a fourth team that is making a climb and trying to get back into that race as well. And so I think I'm going to slow play it for now. Unless somebody makes me a better offer, I'm going to slow play it for now.
Definitely the move. So, folks, we have plenty more to talk about, a couple more news items we want to get into what we're doing today, but we will do all that after this break. Welcome back, Keeper Cut Podcast, episode 103, the Babe Ruth episode. We're talking a lot of prospects so far, but that's definitely not the focus of the episode. Before we get into the focus, though, we have to talk about the bad news. So we talked about some fun news, prospects performing well, Elly De La Cruz, and everything was roses and great, and now we got to talk about some bummers. And let's start off with Vinny P, because I'm just going to keep kicking the Chris Sale thing down the line as far as I can. Hopefully we run out of time and we can't talk about it. Vinny P has been shut down on the IL with shoulder something. What was it, Chad?
I think they call it shoulder instability.
Yeah, it just sounds really, really bad. And Vinny P wasn't performing to the level that people were hoping so far. I wouldn't say he was like a disaster. He wasn't crashing and burning, and he doesn't have a lot of swing and miss in his game, so it's tough for him to go on prolonged slumps. Kauffman is a tough place to play. The bottom line is, if you took Vinny P in the top 100, well, if you took him above Jose Abreu, good job. But that's about it. Otherwise, you've been pretty disappointed, and now who knows how long he's going to be out for. So, Chad, what do you got for us on Vinny P? How you're placing him in your leagues, and more importantly, what are you doing with him in your long-term formats?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one for me, because I have him in Auto New League 1, and I've been trying to buy some power in that league, and of course, people like Vinny, and people were interested in him, even as the performance was a bit down, and I was sort of refusing to trade him, because I was like, I need like a big power util bat. Like I can just plug him in. Like he's just there and that's fine. And then his performance started slipping and I started having questions and was like, maybe I should upgrade him. There's a team that has Pete Alonso that we were discussing Alonso a little bit. And then it was like, what would a trade that included Pasquantino for Alonso look like? Is that a trade I would make? Cause their salaries, I can't remember exactly what they are, but it's like a sub $10 Pasquantino and like a above $30 Alonso. And then Alonso got hurt and then Pasquantino went on the IL and now all of that's out the window. But I think I'm going to try to trade him. And I think what I'm trying to debate right now for myself is if I'm going to trade him there, which I think is an easy choice. If I were looking to buy, is he a buy low right now? Or is he a guy that you should be worried about? And I think, you know, the team said he's getting an MRI Monday. So tomorrow for when we're recording on Sunday, by the time you hear this, you'll know more about this injury than we know right now. And that may be very telling. It is worth noting. I'm looking at a Kansas City Star article right now that notes that last season he was placed on the 10-day injured list with what they called a similar injury. I don't know what a similar injury means. He missed 17 days with that, recovering from shoulder discomfort. If he's going to have like sort of recurring shoulder things and they're going to take him a couple weeks each time to get over, and so he's going to miss 2 to 4 weeks every season with it or something like that, I'm not super worried about that. That isn't a thing that I'm like, uh-oh. My concern is that this is going to get worse and he's going to miss more and more time, that eventually he'll need surgery and miss a lot of time. On the other hand, maybe that's what explains the sort of lack of power, the lack of offense from him this year. There's some, like, he's only striking out 12% of the time this year. He's walking 9.6% of the time. His BABIP is 250, which is lower than you'd expect from him. And sure enough, his ex-WOBA is higher. It's 350 rather than his 329 WOBA. Not a huge surprise there. But his barrel rate's down. His hard hit rate's down. His max EV is down. Like, he's not hitting the ball as hard. He's hitting the ball better than his results suggest. And so he should have, you know, he should be doing better. And I expect he will do better moving forward. But, yeah, you know, I sort of hope that the shoulder is the issue and that when the shoulder gets right, he's going to come back and look better. But we talked about this with Tatis like a couple years ago, right? Like, the shoulder was always going to be an issue. He eventually missed like a season, right? Now, there were 75 other complicating circumstances with Tatis that don't appear to exist with Pascantino. But, like, I don't know. I almost hope, like, as in, I almost think what would cause me to buy Pascantino right now is if they announced on Monday that after the MRI, he's undergoing season-ending shoulder surgery. If they said he's having surgery, it's happening this week, he is going to be shut down for 6 months from doing anything, and then in December, he's going to pick up a bat again, and by the time February, March rolls around, he'll be right back where he needs to be. Then to me, he becomes an immediate buy in where you're rebuilding. Does that make sense?
It does. I'd still just be so weary about cost with it being a shoulder injury, especially a shoulder surgery. Like, I mean, yeah. I get it. Like, the intention is to fix the guy, but if he's like, you know, $16 right now, he's going to be 18. He's going to be still relatively unproven. Like, look, he had a phenomenal year last year, but we still don't know what to make of Vinny P in terms of a ceiling or anything like that. So it's actually a pretty sizable investment for a guy coming off of a serious injury and still not in a great lineup. All right, well, that's not fair, though, but still not in a great ballpark.
His median price in Auto New right now, his median price is $7.
Oh, then yeah, then he's a buy.
Right.
If you're getting him for seven, he's a buy. I guess I was looking at it too much from my own perspective. I've got him in league, what is this, 13, and he got hit pretty hard in inflation. Oh, no, okay, I have him for $9. I thought I had him for $14. Okay, then I changed my mind. If we're talking single digits, then yeah, I'm buying. Because he will go for more at auction. There's no question. 100%. Especially with inflation.
For sure he will.
Yeah.
And so that's where to me it's like, okay, if that's what this is, and then, you know, it's like the ideal circumstance, if you're for his long-term outlook, the ideal thing I'm looking to hear is he's been dealing with shoulder discomfort on and off ever since the injury last year. It's never gotten completely right. He was trying to avoid surgery. Clearly that didn't work. He's undergoing surgery now. His season's over, but he'll be ready to go next year. Like, that is sort of the best long-term outlook. I think the scariest long-term thing is you get one of those, like, we're going to try to work through this. We're hoping it'll be back in a couple of weeks. We'll have to see. Because then you start worrying about, like, you know, does he stumble around this season, not perform very well because of the shoulder, and then come back and have some pain in spring training and end up with surgery in April, right? Like, so I want to see more news. I think where I have him and I'm contending, I'm gonna shop him. I think you have to, because he hasn't been good and now he's hurt. And I think his value is certainly down from where it was 6 months ago. But I think I want to see what the return could be. I don't want to sell too low, but I would sell down from his peak. I would sell down from his peak to get something that helps me now if I'm contending.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I'm probably going to start looking to move him, especially it's coinciding nicely. Not that it's good that he got injured, but Tristan Casas is starting to look a lot better and better and better at the plate, it feels like, each day. So it's a simple replacement for me. Casas has been riding the bench. I realize not everybody that has Vinny P has such a nice and seamless alternative, though, so that's going to be a little bit of a nightmare, and selling might be the only option. Chad, I guess that means we now have to talk about these four players. Now, the first thing I want to mention here is, so Chad just listed Sale, DeGrom, Alonso, Judge in the notes. Three of those four I have in League Two. Keeper Cut Listener League 2 on Fantrax, where I also have Julio Urias, O'Neill Cruz. I drafted Jose Abreu. Like, if it could have gone wrong in that league, it's gone wrong. I just needed to let that, you know, just send that out into the atmosphere and release that from my soul. So Listener League 2 has been an absolute, and I'm still competing. I'm not ready to sell, so please don't send me selling offers. Anyway, I think we can blast through Judge here, right? Judge is the swelling's already gone down on the toe. He's going to be back real soon. He's the best, arguably the best player in baseball. DeGrom, I'm not sure what there is to say, because for me, and Chad, let me know if you disagree. Almost no matter what price I have him at in Ottnew, it's a cut, because it's too big of a player to just eat a season on.
Yeah.
And like, I just don't know if there's anything more to say. He's not a keeper anymore in keeper leagues, and he is a cut in Ottnew.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, you're at this point hoping he's back next year at the end of the season, and he's probably not.
Right. So he's a cut. And Pete Alonso, that one sucks. He's out for 3 to 4 weeks. He was performing at an awesome... I mean, we were just talking about National League MVP. Pete Alonso was right in the thick of that until this injury. So that one definitely hurts. And then Chris Sale, who is shut down with a stress reaction in his shoulder. It's tough to tell just how severe it is, because it's Chris Sale and the Red Sox have a ton of money invested in him. He's hurt all the time. So is this like a, we're going to put him on the 60-day and hope that he's okay after that? Like, we're taking an abundance of caution by shutting him down for this long. We're performing above our heads, but maybe we see the writing on the wall a little bit here. We want to make sure our ace investment is doing okay. At the same time, this could also be something pretty serious. It sounds like we're not going to know a whole lot more in terms of a timeline for a while. All we know is that he was placed in the 60-day IL. He's frustrated. Obviously, the team's frustrated. The fans are frustrated. Apparently, Jacob DeGrom had the same injury last year, and it basically shut him down for the season. But that's also Jacob DeGrom, who we know is dealing with a UCL issue and all sorts of stuff. Sale was, and people are going to laugh and say this is, he was healthy. And by the way, he was pitching like an ace. He was double-digit strikeout games, quality start after quality start. You can look at the ERA and say one thing, but that's really just inflated by his first couple of starts when he was coming back. Because his look at his whip. I mean, Chris Sale was an ace again. He was doing it. It was real life. He was pitching like an ace. The strikeouts were obviously there. One of the best K9s in baseball. And here we go again. So I don't think he's a cut, unless we find out he's done for the year, because if this is an abundance of caution where we're just going to shut him down, get him 100% again, and we'll see him again in early August, then like, he could be still really valuable for you in early August, especially in head-to-head leagues, which is why I had to cut other names in Listener League 2 and not Chris Sale. But man, that one is an absolute gut punch, especially with the state of pitching. So Chad, how are we, or what are we doing with Chris Sale, and what are we doing to replace Pete Alonso? Because he's obviously not a cut, but that's a tough bat to lose.
Yeah, I think if I'm contending and I need to replace Pete Alonso, it depends a bit on what's going on with my first base situation. And the reason I said is, like, I'm trying to pull up, I've got Alonso in at least one league where I'm contending, and I can't remember which one it is. Let me see if I can find it. Ah, my food and travel league. I've got Alonso at first base. Obviously not right now. The only other true sort of pure first baseman on my roster in that league is Carlos Santana, who I'm not excited about using. And then I've got Luke Raley. He's first base eligible. Alex Kirilloff is first base eligible. Nolan Jones. Goodness, Nolan Jones has been so good since he came up. He's first base eligible. And Lamont Wade Jr., first base eligible. So I'm rotating those guys through, because in addition to those four, who are all very useful outfield bats, I also have Judge on that team. That team has taken a big power hit in the last week. Hopefully that'll get better soon. But I also have Lourdes Gurriel Jr., Jack Sawinski, Brian De La Cruz. I just got Adam Duvall back. Like, I'm cobbling together some outfield success and first base success. But in that league, my priority is now probably buying a first base bat. Because when because the here's the thing is, Alonso's going to be back. But when he comes back, I'll have room at first base and DH because I don't have another, or util, because I don't have another true first baseman clogging that spot up. In League 32, I don't have Alonso anymore, but there was a period of time where I had both Alonso and Matt Olson. And if I found myself in a situation where I had Alonso and Matt Olson, or any sort of setup like that, I'm not going to make a big splash trade for a big first base bat. Then I'm looking at, like, do I want to pick up a guy like Brandon Belt if he's available? Do I want to pick up, like, just somebody who I can use on occasion as needed, who can be a platoon type guy in my util spot along with whatever outfielders I have? Or if I'm going to make a big trade, I'm going to make a big trade for an outfield bat or a middle infield bat or something like that, where that person can slot in at util for now and then displace my fifth outfielder, my third middle infielder later. So that to me is like, you know, the third choice is in a league where you've got something like Olson and Alonso or some combination of top, you know, 1B util bats. Like, you could also just wait. What are they saying? They're saying 3 to 4 weeks for Alonso. Is that right? So with 3 to 4 weeks, it's like, I can wait that out if I need to, if I've got good enough options at, you know, on my roster. But I don't want to, you know, you want to be careful about going overboard, replacing a guy, and then you've spent your trade capital on a position where you don't actually need help for the second half of the season. So, but I am trying to right now figure out, like, who do I play at first base in this food and travel league? Like, I need to find a first base bat because I'm missing power in a big way right now.
Carlos Santana is not going to do that for you. No. And I think it's anecdotal, but the way in which a manager in the Keeper Cutout New Listener League replaced Pete Alonso, I thought was pretty on point with what you were just saying, where it's not somebody who had both Alonso and Olson, but instead traded Alonso with a prospect to get Matt Olson, just to bridge that gap here. Rather than be without an elite first baseman for a month, he's going to maintain an elite first baseman all the way through the rest of the season, knock on wood. The prospect was Marco Luciano, so you shouldn't really have to attach a lot. If it's a team selling with Olson and you have Alonso and they're pretty close in price, most people would rather have Alonso for the future. So I would make that swap to make sure I'm staying competing. Chad, that finally takes us to what we're doing today. Now, I don't think we're going to have enough time to get through all of these names. So let me give the parameters to folks, and then I'll read through all of the names that kind of qualified for this list. So as a reminder, two episodes ago, Chad and I kind of broke down guys who were outside the top 200 in ADP on NFBC, and yet were performing like top 50 players on the ESPN player radar. And there were a lot. There were quite a few that were sticking out as guys who like are obviously going to have immense keeper value because of where you ended up taking them in drafts. And now we're kind of looking at that from the opposite angle. Who are guys who were in the top 50 in ADP on NFBC, but are right now outside the top 200 on the ESPN player radar. Now, we're recording on Sunday, June 11th, so the player radar might adjust a little bit. And Chad, this is how dumb ESPN's player radar is. I would find Trey Turner, and he would be 201. And then if I refresh the page, he'd be 209. But then if I refresh the page again, he'd be 201. And then I refresh it again, and he's back at 209. So I don't know what was going on with ESPN's player radar. It might have just been like it was updating while I was making this, so I think it was a little glitchy. Bottom line, it's not so important exactly where these guys are on the player radar. Instead, it is more they're past 200. They are really killing you because you invested a lot in them, and they're just not performing. Well,
for Turner,
so here are the players.
For Turner in particular, like, even if he, you know, creeps up to like 190 or something, that doesn't really
still
help.
Right. Yeah, that's not doing it for you. So here are the players, and then we'll just dive in. A few of these names we've talked about quite a bit on Keeper Cut recently. Trey Turner's ADP was 2. He's 201 on the player radar. Manny Machado, ADP 15, player radar 389. Sandy Alcantara, 25 ADP, is the 25th player off the board. He's 416 on the player rater, and it doesn't get much better. Michael Harris Jr. was 26th. He went right after Sandy Alcantara in drafts on the NFBC. Player rater 692. Dylan Cease went 43rd off the board. He's 324 on the player rater. Kyle Schwarber, 44th, and he's 256 on the player rater. Shane Bieber, and he's not the only Guardian on here, Chad. He was the 50th player off the board, and he is 268 on the player rater. Let's chunk out that first half before we get to the second half, just so I don't have to read all of these names and run out of breath on the podcast. In that first half, Chad, who do we just have to talk about here?
I mean, I think we have to talk about Turner for sure, right? Like, he was universally a top three pick, top five pick, and he was, for many people, the number one pick. And he's been, you know, not very good. Turner, I mean, his strikeout rate would be, I guess it's technically not a career high, because in 44 plate appearances as a rookie in 2015, it was higher, but
That's a career high.
It's basically a career high, and it's a big jump, right? I mean, if I ignore that rookie season, his career strikeout rate was 17.9%. It's up to 24.2%. That's a huge jump for a guy who, you know, didn't strike out a lot before, right? He's been as low as 13.9% in his career. So his walk rate was 7.1% up until this year. Again, not counting that rookie season. It's 5.7% this year, so he's walking less. His swinging strike rate, like, as big as his strikeout rate jumped, his swinging strike rate has actually jumped more. It was 10.1% for his career. It was actually lower than that for his career. It was 10.1% for his career. It is 15.9% this year. That's a huge shift. Huge shift. And meanwhile, he is chasing a ton more. 40.5% O swing versus 30.6% for his career. He's swinging more as well, but swinging in the zone doesn't really, you know, that's fine. But he's making a ton less contact, and pitchers appear to have noticed, because his first strike rate and his zone rate are both down. So basically, pitchers are throwing him fewer strikes. He's swinging at them more often, and he's making contact less often. And on top of that, his max EV is the lowest max EV he's had in his career. His hard hit rate is down, although only a small amount really relative to his career. His barrel rate is actually right at his career rate. But like, he's, the last few years, his hard hit rate and barrel rates have been up, and that's where we've seen sort of the best of Trey Turner. And now he's sort of falling back down to where he was in his career, if that makes sense. And the problem is that none of that stuff for him was ever elite, right? He wasn't putting up elite hard hit rates, elite barrel rates. They were good. I don't want to make it sound like they were bad, but like, let's pull up his Savant page right now. And last year, if I look at these, you know, fancy pants sliders, last year, max EV was 86th percentile. His hard hit rate was 60th percentile. His barrel rate was 48th percentile. All sort of middle of the pack. This year, all that stuff's down, but it's still middle of the pack-ish. It's more like, you know, 36% barrel rate instead of 50th, 46% hard hit rate instead of like 60th. Like, it's down, but it's not crazy amounts down. But he was, like, he doesn't hit the ball hard enough, and he's never hit the ball hard enough to make up for the kind of strikeout issues and the swing and miss issues he's showing right now. And I think if you want to increase your level of concern, a 15-game rolling WOBA chart for him has basically been on a downward trend since the middle-ish, late-ish 2021. It trended down all last year and basically just picked up right where he left off this year, trending down even more. That's pretty concerning to me. And I'm not sure, you know, he's only 29. He turns 30 later this month. So he's still sort of on the right side of 30, at least for now. He is sort of like a, you know, quick twitch athlete type who maybe age will be an issue, although it seems early for that to be creeping up. But it's been ugly, and it's been ugly, like, as good as last season was. And I don't want to ignore the fact that he was good last season. 2020 was better than 2021. 2021 was better than 2022, right? It is a clear downward trend. And that's true in his strikeout rate, and that's true in his swinging strike rate, and it's true in his overall performance. He's gotten worse each of the last 3 years at all of those things. And when you look at it from that perspective, this year looks like a continuation of a trend rather than an outlier. And that, now, we'll see. He bounces back, and then this year becomes an outlier, and it doesn't look like a continuation of a trend. But right now, it's very easy to look at this and be like, yeah, this is not good.
I understand. It's obvious. It's gone downhill since 2020, like you said. But this year has taken too much of a leap. Like we could have said last year, like, man, Trey Turner's really going downhill, like you said, and he's still a top five player in baseball. So, like, I'm not so concerned about the trend. Like, it sounds gloomy. It sounds end of world doomsday situation. That's not where my concern is. I don't know what's going on with him in Philadelphia. We've seen players sign these big contracts before, and the first year out of the gate is a disappointment. I guess my best defense here is Trey Turner. Like, I just kind of expect him to turn it around. The thing that concerns me is that this year the strikeout rate has been pretty consistent every month. Like, it's not like it was like a really, really bad April and it went up in May and now it's getting better in June. The WRC plus is way up in June, but I wonder how much of that is just because we played 9 baseball games or whatever, and he had that one game against Detroit where in 4-for-5 with 2 home runs. He then went 0-for-3 in both of his next 2 games. So he hasn't really gotten a chance, I guess, or given himself a chance to really get going here. Full season samples are more helpful than 2.5 months. And so I'm going to hope that Trey Turner gets it going here. But there's no question that if you kept him or you used, which you had to, some expensive draft capital to get him, you have been disappointed. Let's just hope he stays in the field and turns it around. Chad, the name on here from that first half that I kind of wanted to get into here is Kyle Schwarber, because Manny Machado was one that I wanted to, but I think he's fine. He's been awesome since he's come back from injury. But Kyle Schwarber, like, I don't know. Is he just what we thought maybe he was going to be a few years ago? In the last couple of years, especially last year being second in baseball or third in baseball in home runs, was that like an outlier and he was performing above his head? Or like, what do you make of Kyle Schwarber? It's June 11th and he's batting 175.
So it is June 11th. He's batting 175. I have no argument for that. I will note that since May 7th, so a little over a month ago, he's batting 173, which is even worse, but he has a 137 WRC plus in the last 5.5-6 weeks. 377 WOBA. He's hit 10 home runs in 128 plate appearances. That's like a 50 home run pace over a full season. And I sort of think, like, in that stretch, he's walking a bit more. His strikeout rate is fine. His BAPIP is atrocious. It's 172 for the year. It's 135 over that hot stretch I'm talking about. I kind of think he is what we thought he was, and he's going to just be back to it. But I think, like, I think that's a good thing. Like, he has 17 home runs this year. He's on pace. Like, his pace right now is over 40, over maybe even over 50. No, it's not quite over 50. It's over 40 though. Like, his rest of season projections, Zip says 24 more home runs. Steamer says 22. The Bat says 25. The Bat X says 26. Errol Cohen's ATC projections say 24. Almost all of those have him ending the season with over 40 home runs. And every single one of those requires him to slow down his homer pace the rest of the way from what he's on now. So he is on pace to put up 40 to 45 home runs, just like the 46 he put up last year. He hit 218 last year with a 240 BAPIP. He's hitting 175 this year with a 172 BAPIP. His line drive rate is up this year from last year. His fly ball rate's down a little bit, but not very much. His home run per fly ball rate is steady. He's not really chasing more. His contact rate is down a bit, and his swing strike rate is up a bit. But like I said, his strikeout rate's been fine. I kind of think this is all just noise. His ex-WOBA last year was 375. His ex-WOBA this year is 373.
So I guess part of the issue is not so much that it's like maybe he's had bad luck so far, sure, but he's going to need good luck to get his numbers to look like they were last year. Even if he's on pace for the same power stuff, I mean, like he's going to need some good luck to get that average back up to 220, which is as unfortunate as to talk about average. It's one of the five categories that most of us play in. And I think there was some thought. I know there was a lot of thought, and he was getting pushed up in drafts because the shift is gone and his BABIP's going to be higher. And his batting average might even be higher. There were analysts talking before the season, like maybe he hits 260. And what would a Kyle Schwarber stat line look like if he hits 260? Because the strikeout rate's bad, but it's not like egregious. It's not like, you know, O'Neill Cruz when he first got called up or something, or Gunnar Henderson this season. So I think that's where the concern is. Maybe my expectations were too high. But if he is just a 220 at best this season, we'll see if he gets up to 220. Maybe it's safer to say if he's a 210 with 40 homers and, you know, I don't know, 80 runs, 80 RBI. Is that great? Like, is that what I drafted him to do within the first 50, 60, 70 picks? I don't know about that. So I am starting to get a little concerned with Kyle Schwarber here. I understand the underlying stuff looks good, or I should say looks consistent. But until it starts showing in the field, that's only going to do me so good.
But I kind of think it is showing in the field. I think that's what I'm getting at. It's like the only thing that's really down is his batting average. And that's almost entirely BABIP, right? So will he get up to 220 for the season? I don't know. Will he hit 220 the rest of the way? Yeah, I'm pretty confident he's going to be the same hitter he was last year the rest of the way, because he's been the same hitter so far this year. And like, if you look at his runs pace, last year he put up 100 runs, 94 RBIs. He is on pace right now for about 85 to 90 RBIs, about 90-ish runs. Very similar to last year. A little bit down, but again, a little bit of BABIP helps with that. On home runs, I already said he's basically on the same pace. He's going to put up, what he isn't doing, which is interesting, is last year he stole you 10 bases. He's got zero this year.
I was just going to say that. That was a big part of his value.
Yeah.
Like now, 10 stolen bases. He only has
22 stolen bases for his career. So I have no idea why he stole 10 last year. I don't know. I also thought like with the bigger bases, like, okay, maybe he chips in 5 to 10 again. Maybe he does. Maybe he ends up getting 5.
He just gets on base so much that like, I don't think it was, I think it was crazy to draft Kyle Schwarber for steals. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. If you were hoping to get 10 again, but like if you thought his BABIP was going to go up and his average, and as a result, his OBP, I don't know, eight steals, sure, but we're not even getting there. He's just empty power.
Yeah, I think what I'll say is, I think if people were drafting him expecting a like another level from him, that was probably unfair expectations on him. If you were drafting him thinking this is a guy who's going to smash 40 plus home runs with a low average and get me plenty of runs and RBIs and maybe chip in 5 stolen bases, I think that was fair expectations, and I don't think my expectations have changed that much, except now you're probably only going to get 2 or 3 stolen bases instead of 5. Other than that...
I think that's what it is, because I agree with you. Like, I think that's probably what you're going to get the rest of the way, but I do think there was a lot of people, and I think it's shown in his ADP. There were people that thought he was going to be better than this because of that ban and the shift, and that just has not mattered for this guy, clearly.
Yeah.
So we spent a lot of time bashing the Phillies. Well, Chad defended one of them. I guess I defended Trey Turner. Let's do the second half of this list here. We've got, and we can circle back because I know Shane Bieber was on that first half, and you might want to talk about him. We got Teoscar Hernandez. He was drafted 64th off the board. He is 224 on the player radar. I will remind people that I believe it was just last year he got off to a terrible start, and then after that had like a 150 WRC plus for like 4 months. So Teoscar could bounce back. Alek Manoah, we've talked about enough, but I want to say it anyway. He was the 66th player off the board. He is 1,141st on the player radar. Dansby Swanson, who you mentioned had this awesome war, sixth best war in the National League. Well, he was the 75th player off the board. He is 225 on the player rater. Andres Jimenez, there's that second guardian, 77th player off the board, 358 on the ESPN player rater. Tim Anderson, who, as you reminded me before the show, did miss some time, but he's just been bad. 82nd player off the board, 450 on the player rater. Then we got Gunnar Henderson, who's getting hot lately, but he was 86th off the board, 341 on the player rater. And finally, Wilson Contreras, 87th player off the board and 345 on the player rater. There were a lot of players after 90 and before 100 that would have fit the bill, so capped it at 90. That's a lot of names, Chad. We'll include Bieber in there as well. Who do you want to break down there?
So I do want to talk quickly about Jimenez because he's been better lately. He hasn't been good lately necessarily, but his strikeout rate has trended way down to the point that his rolling strikeout rate right now is like for an extended period of time, a 2-week period of time, he has maintained a lower rolling strikeout rate than he had at any point last season. And the only time maybe in his career that he's been that low was for like a single day back in 2021. But like he is actually like, actually there was a single day in 2021 and there was a couple days in 2020. But like he is putting up the most consistently impressive low strikeout rate he has in his career over the last 2 weeks. And in that time, his WOBA has crept back up. And I think Andres Jimenez is going to be fine, is I think what I'm getting at there. I don't have a lot else to say about him. He was bad, and I think this may have been a case of him. I think part of it is just he was cold to start the season. I think part of it is he might have been trying a little too hard at times. Like his swing rate's up a little bit, but like his contact rate is fine. His swing strike rate is down from last year. His home run per fly ball rate.
So Chad, when you say he's going to be fine, are you saying you expect him to be a top 100 player rest of the season? Because I think that's good intel for folks, and that definitely makes him a buy low.
I mean, I think if I'm I have a hard time evaluating this. If I look at him the rest of the season, I think he ends up back on a 15 home run. So last year he had 17 home runs, 20 stolen bases, hit 297. I don't think he hits 297. I think that was, you know, part of that was like his home run per fly ball rate was a little high. Part of that was a 353 BABIP. Like I don't think he hits 297. Does he hit 275, 270-ish? I think, yeah. Does he end up right back on a 15 home run, 20 stolen base pace the rest of the way? Yeah. So I think if you look at what he did last year and regress the average down, I think the rest of this sort of falls in a line. He also last year, he only had 66 runs and 69 RBIs. And like, he's sort of on pace for more runs this year and a little bit fewer RBI. But I also think as he gets better, he has an opportunity to move up in the lineup in a way he didn't last year. Because I think there's a chance they're finally going to tire of Ahmed Rosario hitting second. And Jimenez, if he gets going, is sort of an obvious guy to slide in there. We'll see if that happens. But yeah, I mean, I think last year with lower average, rest of the way.
Okay. So I would classify him as a buy low, and I think you could probably get him pretty cheap because not only has Andres Jimenez disappointed, I think we've seen some second basemen late in drafts. Jonathan India definitely comes to mind, who have overperformed, or maybe not, that's not the right term, but have outperformed expectations. And so there may be teams out there who are just looking for a reason to move on from Andres Jimenez. And I think that would be a good move. What other names on this list, Chad, and we can kind of open up the whole thing, stick out to you as guys we need to talk about here because something's not adding up.
I mean, we going back to the top half of the list, Michael Harris, who we did talk about recently, but when we talked about him recently, we were talking about how good his X stats were and his Statcast data looked great. And now it looks terrible. And then he had the knee brace come off and said he was feeling better. And this was like the first time he'd felt normal and so long and all this stuff, which is like great to hear. And he said it all after having like, it was like on the seventh, he had three hits. He hit a home run in that game. And he's now played four games and been like awesome for those four games. I have no idea like what you do with that. I think I traded him away in a league recently, and I think if you're buying low on him, and I kind of would like to find a space where I feel comfortable buying low on him. But if you're buying low on him, it's no longer like the X stats look great. He's smashing the ball. It's just a matter of time. It's now very much a like, maybe the knee was messing him up more than we realized, and he's just finally healthy. And that's a little bit of a hard gamble to take. And I think even like this four game stretch that's been better since we sort of got that news, he in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 games before that, he had a total of 3 hits, 2 walks and no extra base hits and was striking out like half the time. It's like he was atrocious for 10 days. And now he's been really good for 4 days. And that's what you're buying on is like, yeah, but he got the brace off. He's feeling better. But even that, the last of those, like yesterday, he was 0-for-3 with a strikeout again. I mean, there's not a lot to buy on. And so what I'm struggling with is like, I keep wanting to buy low on him. And I haven't found the place I want to do that. And most of that's because I only really have one league right now where I'm selling, and it's a 4x4 league where I think his value is about as low as it's going to be. Like, he's hitting 9th in the lineup, so he isn't scoring a lot of runs. He doesn't have I don't expect him to have huge power, so I don't expect the slugging percentage to be huge. Like, it's sort of a bad format for him, and I don't want to buy him there. And in the leagues where I'm contending, where like I like his speed, I'd like him in a 5x5, I don't feel confident enough in the turnaround to want to buy him right now and then be reliant on him.
If I'm contending, there's no way I'm buying him. But I think Michael Harris everywhere is so inexpensive in terms of draft capital, in terms of cost. Even if it's in Ottnu, I'm sure his average salary is super low. If it's in a round-based keeper league, like it's last round value. Or up two or up one, depending on your league setting. So if I'm buying, I definitely have interest. It's just more finding somebody who is willing to sell so low for an asset that was not only so good last year, but also incredibly cheap. He is a weird player. I'm having a hard time myself because going into the season, I was lower on him than the consensus. And that sounds like a victory lap. It's not. It's actually giving me a hard time right now because it's like, well, I didn't expect him to be this bad. Right. So like, was I just extremely right? Or is there something that I'm clearly missing here? And I don't think it's that I was extremely right, because I don't think anybody was expecting Michael Harris to be unrosterable, which is basically what he's been so far. I'm going to give hope to their Atlanta is good at churning out players. It's an awesome lineup. Even if he does hit 9th, like if he's performing well, he's a player that's hitting 9th that's actually worth rostering.
Let me ask you a very specific question here. You and I are currently 1st and 4th in the Podcasters Ottnu League. Okay? It's a new league this year. And so Harris's cost in that league, his median salary in Ottnu is like $9. But in this league, he's expensive. Right. He's $37.
Yeah.
He is on...
Whew. Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was going as like a 2nd round, 3rd round pick, right? I mean...
Not for me.
Fair enough, I'm just saying.
That's crazy money.
$37. He is... on Carlos Marcano's team that is currently in 7th place. Carlos has not suggested that he is selling. So, you know, Carlos, if you're out there listening, I'm not telling you you have to sell. You're still in the mix to get back into the top 3 or 4. Maybe that's what you're trying to do. I don't know. But if he decides to sell, Harris becomes both an obvious sell for him at $37 and a guy that... I mean, you should be able to trade nothing for him at the right.
Like, right.
Are you
get would the you whole loan covered? Obviously,
you and I, like I said, both in the running in that league. I am currently leading that league in stolen bases, but only by 1 and then 5 over the next 2 teams, and so could use some more stolen bases. I am way in the bottom in batting average. It's where I need more help than anything else. I'm 10th in batting average. That's the offensive category I need the most help with. And Harris should be able to help there if he gets right. You, let's see where you are. In stolen bases, you're fourth in stolen bases, it looks like. And again, there's a team right behind you. There's a couple teams, 6 and 11 ahead of you. Teams you could theoretically catch up with. You're middle of the pack in average. Is he a guy that you would buy in that league?
It's such the cop-out fantasy analyst answer. It depends on the cost. So if we were to talk cost, like what would it actually cost me? Like, I don't know, is Joey Weimer for Michael Harris, a $3 Joey Weimer. So he's actually a probable keep for an unkeepable Michael Harris Jr. I mean, he'd have to seriously scorch the earth to be worth $39 next year. Is that fair enough? And like, if that's what it is Carlos even doing that trade? Like, if that's what I can do, if I can just give up a $3 Weimer and get Michael Harris Jr. completely covered, like, sure, I'll do that deal. Why not? I don't have a huge need in the outfield, but I mean, I guess he's, but is he near the top of my wish list for buying? No. Like, if I have assets to move for somebody, then probably not going to be Michael Harris Jr. I think he's a tough guy to buy at such an expensive price when you're trying to contend.
Yeah, I mean, looking at your other prospects there, like, actually, like, if I'm Carlos and I could get Weimer for him, I think I would do it.
Right.
I don't think that's
that. Why I said him. I mean, that's like the most I'd give up, though.
Yeah. Well,
unless he wants Lance McCullers.
That's like, I'm looking further down and like, Sedana Rafaela. Is he, I mean, I think he's lower value than Weimer. I might be okay. Like, if I'm Carlos, I might take him.
Would you cover the whole loan and just take Rafaela for Harris Jr.? Because I don't have a lot of money to spare here. And if he's not willing to take the whole loan, I can't make that trade.
No, that's an interesting question. And I think, you know, maybe you get into my team and maybe my team, like, I could take on, I wouldn't want to take on his full salary, but I could take on a decent sized chunk of his salary. I don't like spending on prospects. And so like, I'd be looking at like, you know, would I trade Alec Bohm, Harold Ramirez? Edouard Julien is really the sort of the closest thing I have to a prospect on that team, unless I go into my pitching. And then I've got like Smith Shaver, Bobby Miller. But I also like, I'm not trading Miller for him. I'm probably not trading Shaver for him. Those are the guys who are being requested for like a Sandy Alcantara trade that I'm not sure. Right. I even feel like, I mean, I'm basically being offered Alcantara for Miller and Smith Shaver. And like, I'm not actually sure I want to do that because Alcantara's just been not that good.
He was much better his last start.
So like,
still not getting the strikeouts.
Yesterday,
we know that.
7 innings, 4 strikeouts and 2 walks. He had a better BABIP really his last start. Like that's what it was. Like, and the White Sox are, you know, bad. So
very.
Right. That's like he faced a bad lineup. Like,
no,
I mean, this is weird. His last 2 starts, I actually said his previous start before that when he faced Oakland, who's terrible, he had a 6.43 ERA, but he had a 1.27 FIP. He went 7 innings. He struck out 7. He didn't walk a hitter. And I was like, he didn't give up a home run. And I was like, that's what I want to see. Then he comes back out this game and like, he's got a 1.29 ERA, which is, you know, wonderful, right? 1 earned run, just 3 hits. The whip is good, but like 4 strikeouts, 2 walks and a home run over 7 innings is not a good performance.
Right. Not for him anyway.
Right.
Especially the homer. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I'm not super excited about what I saw. Like he had 100% left on base rate and a 111 BABIP in that game. Now, looking at something like left on base and BABIP for a single game is not meant to be. I'm not saying like that's who he is, blah, blah, blah. But like my point is just like that's why last night looked good. His start looked good because the guys who got him base didn't score and because the balls in play fell into gloves. Otherwise, I don't know. None of it was that good. His ground ball rate was back up, right? So his ground ball rate.
See, that's kind of who Sandy is, though, right? I mean, he's never he posted a lot of volume in terms of strikeouts last year. Yeah. And I think we'll probably look back at last year as an anomaly, not an anomaly, but definitely an outlier season for Sandy anyway. But, like, you know, soft contact and getting guys to ground out, it's kind of his game.
The ground, that's true, but he's still walking way too many. And he's still not striking out nearly enough, right? So, like, I it's not that I expect him to strike out, you know, 10 guys per nine inning. But his last five starts, he's striking out six per nine inning. His last five starts, he's walking 3.66 per nine. That's almost double what he was doing last year. That cannot work for him. Like, his ground ball rate is, you know, back up to about 50% over that stretch. That's nice to see. His home run per fly ball rate is only 5.9% over that stretch. That's nice to see. But that's a mediocre pitcher. Even with the volume he's going to give you, that's a mediocre pitcher. And it's just not enough. It's not enough. And so, I don't know. To me, if I'm getting into Sandy Alcantara, is he on our list, by the way? I feel like he should be. Oh, he is. Yeah.
He was. Yeah.
So this is we pivoted from our list to talk about this Michael Harris theoretical trade, which got us onto our podcaster league, and now I'm back to the list with Sandy Alcantara. I think he's sort of like right now he's just a blah starting pitcher. He doesn't do anything for you. He eats innings, and that's it. He's like, I don't know. He's like what I keep thinking Wade Miley should be, although Wade Miley keeps posting low. Well, he's hurt now, but he keeps posting low ERAs somehow. But like, and I'm sure Alcantara, like, that is not to say that, like, oh, I wouldn't trade Wade Miley for him. I would. I for sure would. I think he's better than that. But like, he has not yet consistently shown that he's going to be successful. He had, like, if I want to qualify him, like, a good start as low walks and decent strikeouts, he has had, I'm not sure he's at a point this year where I can say, oh, plus innings. So let's redefine this. A good start for Sandy Alcantara has to be six plus innings. It has to be either a strikeout per inning or maybe one off from that. And it has to be like one walk. Right. If he walks two, if he doesn't get enough strikeouts, if he doesn't go deep enough in a game, he's not giving you what you want. I don't know that he has had two consecutive starts this year that I would qualify as good starts. He did have on May 7th and May 13th at Chicago and then versus Cincinnati. He went 8 1/3, striking out nine without a walk, and then went 7 2/3 with nine strikeouts and two walks. I said one walk. You go almost eight innings, you strike out nine, you walk two, I'll give you a pass in the second walk. We'll call that two good starts in a row. That's it. That's the only point this season where I can say he's put up consecutive good starts. And most of the starts have been bad. So I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see him put up maybe at least another two good starts in a row, maybe three good starts in a row. Because right now, I can't even point out what is tripping him up that's going to get better. And it's just, yeah. I'm looking at an article on Fangraphs right now talking about pitches that have fallen off the most. And his changeup apparently went from his best pitch to one of his worst. This is an article by Nicholas Gout, and it's just from a few days ago. It's pretty interesting, actually. But he's talking in here about how, like, the physical characteristics of the pitch look very similar. Hitters are approaching it the same way. There's been an increase in launch angle, more balls in the air, and it's got really bad BABIP. But last year, the BABIP against that pitch was 207. This year, it's 429. 429, obviously not sustainable, but neither was 207 last year. And I think what that suggests to me is that, like, yeah, there's going to be improvement here. He's not this bad. but he's not, I don't think he's an ace the rest of the way. I think he's a good starting pitcher, but not an ace. And so then what do you pay for him?
We know he needed the volume to get the strikeouts last year. So like to be an ace, you need to get strikeouts. He did not get them the conventional way by posting a K9 above a strikeout per inning. Instead, he did it by just pitching a ton of innings. And that might be part of his problem right now is I brought this up by the last week or the week before. This dude has thrown 434 innings over the last two seasons. I just wonder if it's catching up to him because nothing else really explains it. Whatever the case may be, I'm kind of with you. Maybe I'm not expecting an ace the rest of the way, but I do think if he does get a little right, he'll still be helpful in the ratios. So if you're comfortable in strikeouts and you can get this guy because you're behind on ERA, you're behind in WHIP because you've rostered pitchers like Alek Manoah or whoever any of these other massive amounts of quote unquote aces have busted, then I think he could be pretty valuable if you can get him low. But trying to get someone to sell low on him is probably going to be the difficult move here.
Yeah, I think that's the problem is like right now, again, in that podcaster league, the ask that's being made is Smith Shauver and Bobby Miller. And like,
well, yeah, no way am I doing that.
No way. For getting future value, are you really going to tell me that you're confident that Alcantara is going to be better than Bobby Miller the rest of the way? I'm not totally confident in that.
I was just going to say, on a per inning basis, Bobby Miller's already been better.
And I think, by the way, this is the other thing that's worth pointing out. When you're talking Otter-New, and it's one of the things that is different and people don't think about, and this is one of those league-setting things that really matters. In Otter-New, or any format that has an innings cap, Alcantara is bad for strikeouts. His volume no longer matters because he's getting you low strikeouts per nine. And when you know you are capped at 1,500 innings or whatever your innings cap is for your league, if you have an innings cap, Alcantara is bad for strikeouts. There's no path to him being good. He can't volume his way into being good. And that caps his value. Like, he is much less valuable in those leagues. Because here's the thing is, like, in an NFBC or in like one of our listener leagues, innings is a category. I can't remember which one it is. I think it's the Roto. Innings is a category. In those leagues, every inning he pitches over a sixth, seventh, eighth inning in a start, those are just bonus, right? And so if he doesn't even strike out that many in those innings, every one of those strikeouts is a strikeout you can't get somewhere else. Everyone, like, it's just extra. It's just value above and beyond what you can get. In Otter-New, you can throw 1,500 innings. That's all you can throw. And if Alcantara throws you 240, that's great. If he throws you 180, you can get those 60 from someone else. And because of that, his value is much lower in those formats where innings are capped. And so pay attention to league settings. Always pay attention to league settings. That's sort of, we'll make that my parting wisdom for this episode. because this is a really good example where it sort of seems like a small thing, but it matters a lot. So like Alcantara in an Otter-New head-to-head league where you have a game started cap is way more valuable than he is in a season-long points or a season-long Roto Otter-New league where you have an innings cap. If your league has an innings cap, then he's less valuable. He just is. And meaningfully so, because he is a net negative on strikeouts instead of being a net positive.
For sure. For sure. Now, I have no idea how long this episode has gone. You know before I do here. Well, I guess that's not true, but you know how long this is as you're listening to it. So this was a good one. There's plenty of names on there that we can discuss a hell of a lot further, but I think we needed a deep dive there on Sandy Alcantara and a couple of those other names too, even though we've touched on Michael Harris. It seems like the tides with him change on a weekly basis, but that'll do it for us for episode 103. Thank you to all our listeners. Thank you to Babe Ruth. Thank you, Chad. And we will catch you next Wednesday.